Call the meeting to order. Rita, will you do the roll call, please?
Mayor Peters?
Here.
Councilmember Borchardt?
Here.
Councilmember Smuckler?
Here.
Councilmember Winholt?
Here.
Councilmember Grantham?
Right here.
President Enns?
Here.
Vice President McHale?
Here.
Director Fongs? Director Lyon?
Here.
Director Foster?
Here.
Thank you.
Ooh, full house. Good job, everybody. At this time, I'll open the meeting to public comment. John?
John Barta. Boy, you guys just jump right into it, don't you, here? I came here to talk about cars, okay? So, because you guys are, you know, you're in the business of buying a car, right? So I'm going to run over there for a second. So, you know, you go down the street to your local car dealer and you say, I like that Cadillac, it's a beaut. And he says, yep, you've known this guy for a while. He said, it's $45,000. Somebody you trust, you've dealt with in the past. But you've got a problem because you go further down the street to the new car dealer, and he's got another sign. You got to understand, this is a package deal. With this package, we got very good technology under the hood there. That aerobic reactor technology requires special attention and good people who know what they're doing. So we won't sell you the car for $30,000, but we will include the mechanic and the driver for the car. And you have to pay them. And if you read the fine print at the bottom, you'll see that you have to pay them for the life of that car. And then at the end of the lease, we may sell it to you. Now, my point for this silly analogy is you have to be comparing apples to apples and oranges to oranges. What's going on in one case is you're actually buying, you're not buying that car for $30,000. That's just a number. You're leasing it, and there's all these costs all the way along the line. And at the end of the lease, what's really going on, or at the beginning of the lease, what's really going on is you're signing an obligation to make payments for a long period of time for a lot of money. And what you really have to look at is what do all those payments add up to? Because what this dealer might be doing is taking that contract that you sign for those payments and turning it around to somebody else in some other kind of deal that you don't even know about. Okay, so when you measure what you're going to do, measure apples to apples and oranges to oranges, and make sure that you're looking at the same thing, okay, and at the bottom line price, the true total cost of things. And I think that there's a comfort level you might have with some technology that's maybe not quite as new, but it's also very good technology and gets the job done. Thank you.
Thank you, John.
Lower list about 3 feet. Bill Martin in Cayuga and Morro Bay. Lived in Cayuga about 35 years and then now in Morro Bay. I agree with John. When you actually have a project, you actually have to look at the total cost. You also have to look at the product and what you're getting with the product, because apples to apples, as you would right now, you would get two sewer plants that put the water out in the ocean, where one PERC is proposing actually recycling the water with a much more sophisticated plant. So take that into consideration as far as the $8 million add-on price tag that we had heard to actually have a sewer plant or a treatment plant like PERC is proposing. And then you compare the $20 million, the approximate cost that they're talking, to the $36 million. And I think just cost alone is a very easy comparable. What I find interesting is at last meeting, rather than the $8 million to actually upgrade to a total, I think it's Title 22 plant, then it became only 10% of cost to do that, which would actually mean $2.5 million approximately, and then it actually dropped down to maybe 5%, $1.5 million. Then I also heard a figure, I thought $12 million or something as far as the RRM, not RRM, but the Montgomery Watson Harza. So it seems like these prices are all over the board. And I realize the $3 million design phase is strictly design phase with no locked-in price. So in considering apples to apples, you actually, if you have a locked-in price like a car, you know what your monthly payments are as opposed to what they may be after the car is built. I know we used to get a Buick at Farmers, and that basin is being used almost to its max. So when you consider a plant, consider not so much the cost of the plant. Consider the cost of Morro Bay possibly not having water wells if you don't ship that water up and recharge the basin because, again, the farmers have first right. Cambria actually recycles their water with no purple pipe. What they do is they ship the water up to their well field. It perks into the well field, and then the water is clean enough to actually recycle it through the town. Morro Bay could do the same thing in the lower basin, recharge it. If the upper basin is overusing the basin or using their water, that means, like where the Wixoms are, that basin would be recharged. They wouldn't be short of water. And then the upper basin would have enough water to operate, and if they didn't have enough water, then they in turn could ship the water further up to meet their demand. So when you're considering this, also consider the water rights of Morro Bay being inferior to the actual users of the basin. Thank you.
Bob, come on up.
My name is Bob Strawler. We're farming up in the Morro Basin. We've been there since 1978. And we have around 27,000 avocado trees producing in that area. And we have quite a few neighbors up the canyon that have trees in production and coming into production. Any concept, whether you're talking about one of the bidders or the other bidder, I'm not really going to get involved in that. I just hope that you folks have enough common sense to pick the best, the cheapest, and the most attractive for the area. We're citizens there. We'd like to see the thing come about. But any idea of the water treatment without reclamation, to me, is something that I cannot even understand, considering the vagaries of weather, knowing that our basin is sometimes recharged on the basis of these periodic El Ninos. Once in a while, we get lucky. The undependability of state water, which, of course, has more and more competitors for it, and the fact that we possibly would have 1 million gallons of potable water available to recharge the various canyons that we have, whether it's Sorrel Canyon or Morro Creek Canyon, Little Morro Creek, clear over to possibly San Bernardo. That's 3 acre feet every day to go ahead and recharge. And the idea of piping is the cheapest possible consideration. The water is the most expensive when you think about the value of it. So let's not forget about the very fact that water probably, as far back as California history, was the most important resource we've ever had. Without it, it's a desert. With it, it's a paradise. Thank you.
Thank you, Bob.
Hi, Grant Crowell, Morro Bay, and I'd like to thank Bob because I'm going to tail end on what he had to say. I'm about fresh water and about our planet, and I was visiting the world to be a better place. It's so they have nothing to say but their facts that they have found. And part of this is brought up because I was told that one of the Cayucas board members said they don't worry about fresh water because they have all that they need. I'm hoping that that's not true. I mean, I'm hoping that they have all that they need. I'm hoping that I didn't hear that incorrectly because this is our basin. This is our bay. It's our ocean. We share this whole area here. And if we're just going to say, well, you know, one part doesn't have to pay attention to fresh water, and the other part's concerned about it, that doesn't feel quite right. And so I'm asking you to really look at these. And I went on the National Geographic website, and there's called a there's a whole section just on fresh water. It says by the year 2050, one-third of the population will be drinking foul water. That's only 40 years away. And we're all young enough that we want to live with fresh water, and we want our kids and grandchildren and everybody to have fresh water. So please, this is probably one of the more important issues that will help make a decision. Orange County has the exact system that PERC is using now, and that's what they're using for their sewage treatment in Orange County, California. So,
thank you, Grant. Anyone else? Jack, I was told you wrote an article. It's on a website or something, and it's not in a magazine. Can you tell us where we can find that?
Yes, I reported an article.
The medium you're referring to is the Slow Coast Journal. It's reachable by www.slocoastjournal.com. And I did have an article on the JPA board's last meeting.
Thank you very much. I heard about it, but I didn't have the website, so thank you. Anyone else? Yes.
Susan Heineman, resident of Morro Bay. First of all, I wanted to thank the JPA board for giving PERC a chance to present their upcoming design and proposal. I was pleased that there was an alternative approach to the agreement that we currently have with Montgomery Watson Herzog, MWH. It's my understanding that we'd agreed to pay MWH $3 million to design the plant, or we terminate the agreement and we would pay them for their work done. One scenario would be to go through with the completion of this design. The plant design would then go out to bid. But then that's what gets scary. The estimate of MWH is a total of $27 million, but that's based on 2006 financial costs to build such a plant. Overrides, which are redesigns when a problem occurs, are common final costs until it's been completed in 2014. And as previously stated, we will pay for every overrun cost that occurs with this design or necessary changes while building. Going with PERC means there'll be no financial surprises for us when the bill comes due in 2014. We will be paying for this project for the next 30 years. So this is a decision that will affect the seniors, the middle-aged people, young families, and local businesses. No surprises versus a blank check. That's quite a choice. Thank you.
Anyone else? Rob, I had a chance to speak with you earlier, and you were very complimentary about the meeting with staff today. Would you care to comment?
Good evening. Rob Aragon on behalf of PERC Water. I did share that with Director Entz this afternoon, and I absolutely want to underscore the process that was initiated today. It was very, very meaningful. We think that it was a good discussion between staff and the PERC team, and I think that we're starting to vet a host of issues that are going to become important to everybody as this process evolves, and simply wanted to share that appreciation. So we thought it was a very good conversation today. Thank you.
Thank you, Rob. And I just wanted to have Rob say that because I wanted to thank staff for the way they've responded to our request. Anyone else? If not, we'll go to consent calendar. Motion would be in order for approval. Morro Bay, would you like to lead or pull for separate discussion?
Anyone wish to pull anything?
I just wanted to pull item A1 for correction.
Okay. And may I hear a motion approving A2 and 3?
Yes, so move.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? None. Okay, Noah, A1?
Yeah, it's just a modest light correction, but Natalia, at the bottom of page 1 of 4 on A1, she is actually a resident of Morro Bay.
Okay.
I believe, still. I saw her out there. Yeah. Yes?
Was that the only item?
That's the only item.
Okay. You want to make a motion to approve that one, then?
With that correction, I move approve A1.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? None.
Okay. Kayukas, consent calendar, you could do one motion.
I move that we approve the consent calendar items 1 through 3.
As amended. I second it.
Is that as amended good for you?
Correct.
Thank you. All right. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Motion carries. Old business. Item number 1, consideration to adopt the draft amendment number 2, the facilities master plan. Bruce, are you going to lead out on this?
Sure. I'd be happy to. The item that's in front of you tonight is the discussion and consideration to adopt the draft amendment number 2 to the facilities master plan. Consultants, and they can take that project description and incorporate it into the draft EIR and complete that document for public circulation and comment. Additionally, adoption of the amendment will allow MWH to proceed on the preliminary design. Actually, it's called the final design process, but would allow them to start the preliminary design of the plant. The amendment is representing the first task in the scope of work, and there was a lot of city and district interaction in terms of the information that you see in the amendment. We did a lot of work on flows and loads, and I'm not going to dive into too much detail on that, but I'm going to let Mr. Highland of MWH kind of talk about that in greater detail in a couple minutes. It also has the flows and loads are included as a technical memorandum at the back of the amendment, and there's also a technical memorandum that discusses tertiary filtration and chlorine contact basin options. The amendment also includes some of the changes to the treatment process that came about from the facilities master plan that was developed by Corollo and amendment number 2 that was developed after the treatment plant site was moved due to the flood hazards. And I'm going to let Steve go into that a little bit. But some of the changes are fairly minor in terms of what they bring to the project, but they're important in terms of operation. And one that I have in mind would be the addition of grit removal and pretreatment prior to water flowing into the ditch. The Corolla design did not have that, and both staff and the designers felt that was an important part. But again, I'm going to let, I think Steve's got a summary of those changes, and I'll let him go through that with his presentation. The next steps, as I stated, is really the environmental review and permitting process, and the critical nature of adopting the amendment is that it allows staff at ESA, which is our environmental consultant, to finalize the project description in the document and then look at the impacts from that project description. We were, prior to moving the plant with the flood hazard analysis, we were close to getting a document out on the street, so we're assuming it's going to take about 4 weeks from the time the amendment is approved to the time that ESA will bring back a document for city and staff review and then subsequent public notice. We're shooting for to release that document on August 16th is really our target goal at this point. That allows the 45-day comment period, and then we will take the EIR to the Planning Commission for a presentation in September, and then we'd bring it back to the Planning Commission for a CDP and CUP hearing before it comes before the council. The critical nature of the environmental review process at this time is it's really the critical path for our project.
We don't. I've included, I believe there's a project schedule at the back of the staff report outlining critical dates. It's a tight time schedule, and that really at this point, the beginning of the preliminary design, and then we'll bring everything back for comparison probably in 2 to 3 months after we receive the CDR. But truly, the project schedule at this point is extremely tight, and it's very important that we get the amendment adopted. And with that, I think I would turn it over to Steve. And up, oh, I'm going to let Rob weigh in here and then turn it over to Steve for his presentation.
Good evening, Council and Board. I just want to make sure that you know that the environmental review, we're going to ensure that ESA includes the analysis of a MBR plant in their EIR. So whichever project moves forward, the EIR, we won't have to go back and revisit that process, and it won't delay our time schedule.
Confirmation, Rob, but from the last meeting, we were going to be receiving a dual CDR that included SBR along with the MBR. Is that also planned to be included?
Yes. Yes, it will be.
In the environmental review?
I think the environmental review for those processes are so similar that the impacts are, you know, there's not a real big difference in impact from those two processes. They'll look at the energy consumption probably would be the major difference between those two processes.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Thank you, Rob. Bruce?
So with that, I'd turn it over to Mr. Highland of MWH.
Thank you, Bruce. Good evening, Council and Board. As Bruce mentioned, we've done a lot of work preparing our draft amendment number 2. At this time, I'd like to thank City of Morro Bay staff and the Cayuga Sanitary District staff for their assistance in making this happen. It was, I think, a really good joint effort, and I really appreciate all the input and advice we got in advancing this document. I think it'd be useful to look first at the project phases that we're moving forward with. First phase will be planning and environmental evaluation, which is where we are now with the facility master plan. In parallel with that will be the EIR that Bruce talked about before. And then we'll move into final design with your approval. And the first piece of work in that phase will be a preliminary design report. And then that will be followed by preparation of specifications and drawings that are the contract documents that would then be used for the next phase of the project, which would be bidding and construction. And this would be to advertise, bid, and award to a general contractor. That general contractor then would construct, start up, and commission the new treatment plant. And once the new treatment plant was in service, then we'd be in a position where we could demolish the existing plant. So that's just the general framework for how the project would advance as it's currently structured. The basis of the upgrade project was to provide capacity for build-up population of the City of Morro Bay and the Cayuga Sanitary District. The plant is going to be relocated to avoid flooding. The treatment technology, or it was discovered that the site was subject to flooding. We had to relocate the site. And then our amendment number 2, the draft in front of you, it consolidates all of this information into one aggregate document. And then this, in turn, as Bruce mentioned earlier, will provide the EIR folks with a project description. The refinements that I want to talk about that are the content of Amendment Number 2 are revision to flows and loadings. We advanced the treatment process concepts. We took a look at the site preparation that's going to be needed to construct the new facilities. We've offered some improvements to plant layout and the way things are oriented and configured. And we also have had a start on some architectural concepts. So I'll talk about each of those in turn as we go along here. First of all, the revised flows and loadings. In the original draft facility master plan that was prepared in 2007, The flows and loadings are based on data from year 2002 through year 2006 data. That was a five-year period. And since that time, data from year 2007 through 2009 is available. And furthermore, there was a concern that the flow data for this period of time wasn't representative of past wet weather years. If you recall, in the late 90s, when we had El Nino years, there was a lot of water from storm events, and that increased flows into the plant. So we wanted to capture that. So what we did is we evaluated a longer period of record for flow. We went back to 1995 to year 2009, the last full year of data that we have. That's a 15-year period of record for flow. And for loading data, we used the starting point of the year 2002, the same as the draft facility master plan, to 2009 for an 8-year period. This table might be a little bit hard to read from your chairs there, but I wanted to show the major differences between the two. As you can see, the average flows did not really change significantly. The critical one is the peak season dry weather flow, which covers the months of July and August. And as you can see in the draft facility master plan, that was 1.47. We have virtually the same number at 1.5 MGD. Where the increased period of record, the longer period of record, starts to kick in is on peak flows. If you start looking at peak month flows, you see an increase from 1.6 to 2.9, a peak day flow of 5.6, and peak hour flow of 5.97 to 8.0. These peak flows don't impact all the treatment facilities, but there's some facilities, for instance, pumping, screening, that are really driven by hydraulic flows. And it's important that we capture from past records what we think that peak flow is going to be. Then in terms of loading, we utilized a longer period of record, and we looked at biological oxygen demand, BOD, and total suspended solids, TSS. And these numbers are very comparable. We like to look at maximum month numbers, but they have important aspects to them. As Bruce mentioned earlier, we want to add grit removal facilities. Those were not included previously. Grit is the inorganic silts and sands of seeds and material that can accumulate. And if you don't remove them, it takes up valuable hydraulic capacity and volume. So we felt it was important to reinstate that. We wanted to consolidate all what we call the residuals handling, and this has to do with screenings that we remove and grit. This is pretreatment of the raw wastewater that comes into the plant. And then the sludge that's produced from the biological treatment. All of these residuals have handling issues with them, truck loadouts, and we felt it'd be valuable to consolidate them all in one place so that we could keep those activities in one location. We had to add a secondary effluent pump station. We looked at the hydraulic profile that's going to be needed to lift the flow from where it comes in with the existing influent sewer to where it has to be delivered to the air release structure that is connected to the existing ocean outfall. We found that unless we went to really high heights, we needed to lift the wastewater two times to go through the treatment plant train. One change, too, is the in the facility master plan is identified that there'd be a single chlorine contact basin with just one chamber. Based on experience that the plants had, which has a similar situation, there are times when they have to take it out of service. When that's happened, they have had violations, and that makes you subject to fines. And so it's just good practice to include two chambers so you can take one chamber out of service and still have another chamber to operate with. And as we mentioned before, we are providing capability for future reclaimed water to meet Title 22 requirements. The facility master plan identified sludge thickening and thickening sludge storage facilities. We feel those aren't necessary. The oxidation ditch is a very capable system of handling changes in sludge amounts, and so we didn't feel the need to have that. And then one thing that I don't think was really identified in the facility master plan is that because we were relocating the plant where the existing sludge drying beds are, once we start construction, those drying beds will no longer be available for sludge disposal. So we'll have to make provisions for temporary sludge dewatering during construction so that we can continue to handle the sludge, keep the existing plant going while we're building the new plant. As I mentioned, we took a look at the site preparation needs. The flood study that's been conducted has predicted floods that will be incurred at the site of in like 3 to 4.5 feet above grade, existing grade. So that'll mean we have to bring an engineered fill for the new wastewater treatment plant. A geotechnical study was conducted by our subconsultant, Food Grow West. They've done a preliminary evaluation based on existing records. We also looked at the plant layout, as I mentioned earlier, and two of the major changes had to do with the location of the operations building and the household hazardous waste station. We felt it'd be valuable to group them together because they're going to be accessible and visible to the public, and that we could provide a public access road to those units. And then we felt it'd be valuable to group the residuals facility, again, this is handling the screenings, the grit, and the sludge, with the maintenance building and the chemical station. There's going to be a fair amount of truck traffic associated with each of these for deliveries of equipment, chemicals, and then the hauling of the residuals. And we can provide a service access road separate from the public access road, so we can separate these functions. Now, again, this may be kind of difficult to read from your seats and with the lighting, but what I wanted to show was this was a site plan from Amendment Number 1. The existing facilities are circled in red here, and they would be subject to demolition. And in purple were the proposed new facilities. And when we looked at these, here were some of the issues we saw that we wanted to address. First off, public access to the household hazardous waste facility and operations building were separated. The hazardous waste facility was located over here. The administration building was located here. The screenings handling here was separate from the sludge handling located here. And as I mentioned before, there is no grit removal. And then there would be truck traffic associated with deliveries and loadouts from the screenings facility, sludge handling, from the chlorine. This would be where the chlorine and sodium bisulfite deliveries would be made, or I should say sodium hypochlorite. And then this was the maintenance building area. So all these would be subject to truck traffic. So our proposed layout that we worked diligently with staff at would be configured like this. The main process units, the oxidation ditch secondary clarifiers, chlorine contact basins are very similar. But we've reoriented things so that now the public access can be made available on a dedicated road. This could be the location for the household hazardous waste facility. This could be the operations building. So public access could be dedicated in this portion of the site, and this would be kind of the public face, if you will, of the treatment facility facing Atascadero Road. We consolidated all the residuals handling, the screenings, grit, and solids, into one facility, one area here. And then when you look at the orientation facilities where the truck traffic for deliveries and loadouts, that would be consolidated in this vicinity here, and we could provide a secondary access road here separate from the public access road. So we worked hard with staff to develop this reorientation, which we think will offer some significant advantages to the long-term operation and maintenance of the facility. And finally, I'd like to talk a little bit about our architectural concepts. Our architect is RRM Design Group in San Luis Obispo. For the treatment facilities. And then the residuals facility will be shielded with screening walls. I think you've seen these graphics before, but I just wanted to repeat just briefly. This is the current architectural concept for the operations building, again, with cement block type construction. Here's another view of the same building, which would have, you know, outdoor stairway for access for staff to the control room. This would be a maintenance building. This would be the residuals facility. Like I mentioned, we'd have the three walls that would shield this facility from public view and would open up on the inside of the treatment plant concept or campus concept that we have. So that's a brief summary of the main elements of Amendment Number 2 that we've developed, and I'd be glad to answer any questions you may have.
Questions from the board or Morro Bay? Go ahead.
Okay, I do have some questions. Thank you for your presentation. My main question revolves around the changes in the amendment too, with the flows and the loads, mm-hmm. and the concern is how that will affect the site, the footprint of the site. It looks from the schematic of the new layout that we do have a larger footprint. Interested in to know what the operations and maintenance impacts would be, and then the construction costs with those changes. I understand that it would be an estimate that you could give us, but I think it's important for us to recognize that. And then, you know, how that would interplay with our rate structure that we currently have, and if there would need to be amendments with that.
Okay. Let me walk through what impacts there are to the facilities that were identified in the facility master plan to what we have now based on the changes to flows and loadings. I'm going to our site plan here. The influent wastewater comes in through this existing gravity sewer, and we'd be lifting it up with an influent pump station at this location. So that those pump stations have to be sized for the peak flow, and since that's increased, then these pumps will be increased somewhat. It probably doesn't affect the physical size of the wet well, just the individual pumps would have to be a little bit bigger, a little bit more horsepower. So there's an incremental cost to there, but fairly modest. The residuals facility houses the screening and grit removal equipment. It will have an impact particularly on the size of the screens because their capacity is really driven by hydraulics more than anything else. So with increased flow, those units will have to be somewhat bigger. The grit removal facility, it wasn't there before, but it would be sized for the peak flow. The solids handling production that's there, we wouldn't expect that to change. The loadings for BOD and suspended solids really didn't change, and so the size of those facilities is not going to change. Walking through, because they're still well within the hydraulic design parameters that we would use. The tertiary filter is currently set at 1.5 MGD, so it remains unchanged. The chlorine contact basin is driven to some degree by detention time, but not so much the detention time at peak flows, because you can compensate for a shorter hydraulic detention time with more chlorine addition. And so it's the coliform kill that you're trying to get in the chlorine contact basin is a function of detention time and dose. And so because these peak flow events would happen fairly infrequently and not at this magnitude very often, we feel comfortable that we can preserve this same size chlorine contact basin. And then the rest of the facilities, the maintenance building, operations building, would remain unchanged. So the changes that the revisions in flow and loadings are going to necessitate are increased pumping capacity, and I've neglected to include the secondary pump station here. It will be affected similarly to the influent pump station there. Fairly modest change there. The screen size will be a little bit bigger. I really think those are going to be the impacts to that. Now, we have not priced these changes yet. In our scope, we will be preparing an estimated construction cost of our design when we complete the preliminary design report, which would be the first part of the final design phase.
And you were going to talk about the operations and maintenance as well as the capital.
There would be an increase in energy cost for pumping these higher flows, but again, very modest because your average flows stay the same. The peak flows that you have to provide that pumping capacity for are going to be for storm events that occur every winter, but many of those storms are going to be similar size to what you have now. We have to design for the worst case event, and looking through that historical 15-year record, we've based our peak flow on the worst case condition that occurred then. So it's kind of like a 1 in 15-year event. So,
our capital and capital costs have definitely gone up in relation to being built to handle the peak flows.
There would be an increase, but again, very modest because it's just an incremental increase in equipment size, really. It doesn't really affect the size of the hydraulic basins or tanks. It just has to do with making pumps a little bit bigger and screens a little bit bigger. So the incremental cost for that is pretty modest.
So within the amendment to discussion in here, when it talks about cost and price of the ratepayer, we see the price now of $31 million in relation to the 27 that was projected in the original facilities master plan. And it seems to point that increase or attribute that increase.
I can see in looking at the costs that have been prepared to date, in some areas I think the original estimate was probably on the high side for some elements and probably on the low side for other elements. And we have made some incremental increases in capacity, as we just discussed, for pumps and for screens. I'm not sure at this point where all that's going to fall out. But that's what we'll be doing in the preliminary design report.
And how does that affect our current rate structure and the schedule?
That's the one I came up to answer. The only utilities capital project. How's that? Don Wade, Utilities Capital Projects Manager. That's the question, or the portion of the question I came to answer. Our rate structure was put in place in 2007 based off of the numbers in the Corolla Report. But in addition to that, the Corolla Report, because it was a planning-level document, it had a 20% contingency in it. And so what happens is you move through the process, and that was a 20% design contingency, effectively, is what you would call that. On top of that, we put a 35% engineering, administration, and legal markup. So there's been a lot of confusion as we move through this about project cost versus construction cost. You go, overall project cost, the impacts that we're talking about should be moderate to minor. We're not talking about, you know, until they've done their estimate, we wouldn't know exactly what it is. But we wouldn't anticipate having to change our rate structure to accommodate that. The way that our rate structure was set up, using the SRF process, we'll have to look at that rate structure again in the middle of 2013. From the city's perspective, I can't speak about the district's rate structure because we did those separately. But you know, from the city's perspective, we know we'll have to come back in 2013 and look at that. We don't anticipate there's been nothing today that makes us think that we're going to have to do significant changes. We basically are going to have to look at it for the SRF process to make sure that we still have adequate rate structure in place to cover the loan that we receive. But the process changes that we've talked about today, the incremental costs of adding, for example, one of the things that's on the agenda tonight is the chlorine contact basin, going from one to two, $240,000 cost. In the $31 million, that's not a significant impact to the project. And so you go... we don't think our rate structure is going to have to change because of the changes that we're making as we move through the design process today. There may be unanticipated events that occur,
you know, maybe we don't get the financing. That would be something that would probably cause us to have to look at our rate structure. But basically, we've designed a rate structure to build the project that you guys have tasked us to build, and we're confident that we've done a good job with that and that that rate structure will support the project.
Now, looking at that contingency and the extra space that we gave ourselves with that rate schedule, we also have some, we haven't committed officially, formally to reclamation yet, but it appears that that is very much our primary goal with the project, eventually to get to that point, and that obviously will have some expense to it. My question would be that you don't view that contingency.
It should get better and better as you add detail to the project. So you go on your design, you go as you move into construction, you'll reduce that contingency often from a 20% down to, like, let's say a 10% would be probably what I would recommend. So as you move through the project, you kind of drop contingency as you go, as you haven't realized some of the risks that are inherent in the project. In regards to using the leftover contingency for reclamation, it's a very good question. And you go, I'm not sure that the wastewater ratepayers can be tasked with developing a water resource, which the reclaimed water facilities would become. And so there's some nuance to that that I, quite frankly, am not prepared to answer at this time. And there's some research that we'll have to do and figure out. It basically is going to boil down to how that's perceived and then ultimately how that's used. Because once you've reclaimed that water and are using it for some beneficial water purpose, should that be borne by the water ratepayer or by the sewer ratepayer? My argument would probably, my initial position and take on is it probably becomes a water resource, and then you would want the water users that are receiving the benefit of that resource to pay those costs. But that gets into 218 and discussions there, and I'll look to the legal if I messed it up at all, but that'd be my initial take on it.
Okay, thanks. A couple other questions I had. Looking at site impacts, we have drawn out the flood impacts, obviously. We haven't addressed the flood itself. We've tried to mitigate the impacts of the flood to the site. We've talked about tsunami, same scenario as far as, with the tsunami, it appears that our plan with the tsunami scenario is to evacuate and leave the site to be impacted as it will by the events. The one thing that we've looked at earthquakes as well. I don't see any mention of sea level rise, which continues to be an elevating concern for the community on the coast. And so I'm just interested to know how that will be looked at. And
it's my understanding that is going to be covered in the environmental document. I think that's part of what ESA will bring back in their discussion and analysis.
That's correct. It'll be looked at in the environmental document. We also did some real kind of quick and dirty as we were going through the flood impacts. We were comparing the elevations of sort of the storm surge and wave run up during a storm event, including sea level rise versus the flooding event. And we found kind of just real quick and dirty work that the flood event governed. So the flood was worse than the storm surge, even with sea level rise, was kind of what our initial work said. But that'll get looked at closer in the environmental process.
So my question is, at what point would we say, if as we go through this analysis, would we say the current site is not compatible with this plan and will the impacts to this site are significant enough to develop an alternative location?
Yeah,
I'm wondering where
the
we ever
the
get
environmental
to that
process
conclusion. For a tsunami event, significant tsunami event, of evacuation being a barrier to this plan?
The way I've kind of told everybody is if we have the 70-foot tsunami in Morro Bay, and the last thing we're going to worry about is wastewater treatment plant. There's going to be...
Well, until the day after when we start trying to resume operations.
Yeah, I mean, a significant tsunami would basically take out everything kind of west of Highway 1 and all of the Embarcadero up to, you know, whatever elevation it reached. And so you go... it would be, it's one of those things where you go, you don't really plan for an event that makes you start over, I guess is kind of the way that you look at it. It would be catastrophic to Morro Bay.
Absolutely.
I don't know if you would ever recover, and if you did, what it would look like.
But I think it seems like it's something that we have to take into account. You say west of Highway 1, that leaves plenty of land east of Highway 1. And I guess my question would be, what would stop the Coastal Commission or another organization from suggesting to us that we look at all those alternative sites to try to avoid that sort of scenario?
That's a great question, actually. You go, why are we sticking to this site? You go, in my mind, there's a very significant reason to stick to the site, and that you go, we've developed an infrastructure, and not an inconsequential investment in an infrastructure in Morro Bay that points to this project site. Our outfall pipe is here, and our incoming lines from both Morro Bay and Cayucas meet at this location. And so you go, if you wanted to move the site, one of the things that we looked at very early on was the most beneficial reclamation project I could envision as the water manager for Morro Bay would be to build the plant out in the Chorro Basin and use the plant's effluent to recharge, to basically artificially enhance stream flow because of our stream flow conditions in the Chorro Basin. We analyzed that alternative. That project was about a $70 million project. A significant portion of that expense was the infrastructure to basically get the effluent from where it's pointing to now out there to make that beneficial use out of it. And so you go, once those numbers kind of came back, you go, you know, we could, there are a lot better investments for $70 million from a water perspective that we could make than using the wastewater plant in that regard. It wasn't really cost effective, so we kind of died on the vine. And you go, the same argument you would make about moving the plant. You go, we can't move the plant without incurring significant additional expense to reroute all of the supporting infrastructure.
Yeah, and I didn't like those. I've reviewed the plan. I have it right here in front of me, actually, and I didn't like those numbers either. That would be a tough pill to swallow. At the same time, we are building a new plant, so this is the one and only time to ever look at alternative locations. Recently, I heard that a previous council and board considered an option up the Morro Valley rather informally, but it was considered. Are you aware of anything that has ever looked at the Morro Valley as an alternative site?
No, from the documents I've seen, I've never heard a reference of that. So if it's out there, I'd love to look at it. I mean, I'll read anything. So if you get it to me, I'd love to read it.
It's a hard thing to talk about moving the site right now, especially paraphrasing it with our time. I'm assuming, the standards today revolving around water use internally within the building, landscaping externally, energy use are all very high. But I would like to hear what your thoughts were, RM's thoughts were about those resource efficiencies within the structures.
Okay. For the occupied buildings like the operations building here and the maintenance building here, RM plans to utilize, good practice in terms of lighting, insulation, ventilation, and all those good things. We've not opted to recommend or suggest you go down like the LEED path, LEED certification, but we want to implement a lot of the types of facilities and attributes that are used in those kind of facilities. Then with respect to the treatment portion of the plant, we specify high efficiency motors. We like to use variable speed drives, variable frequency drives wherever possible to make sure that we minimize the consumption to just match the loads as they come in. So we try to use good practice like that throughout to make sure that we're reducing the energy consumption of the plant.
Okay. I think it's the last question that I have, and it has to do with the discussion that was at the Technical Advisory Committee meeting about alternative uses for peak flows and options. and the idea of a constructed wetland as part of a mitigation for habitat, public improvements, and perhaps even the flood issues to help with the reduce flood impacts was brought up. And one of my questions would be, is that an element that could be brought in, given the space available to, you know, whatever level, that would be an additional discharge option for the plants, particularly the water that isn't treated to full tertiary or to Title 22 standards? Is that something that would be a potential benefit for us to look at, and is that something that you've worked with before?
Yes. Title 22 regs specifically state that use of treated effluent within the boundary of the treatment plant site does not fall under their regulation, per se. In other words, we have the option and we plan to utilize treated effluent for utility water within the plant. For instance, where we have sprays for, like, on our screens, we can use treated effluent for that function because it's confined and it wouldn't be coming in contact with the operators. Pumps use what they call seal water, modest amount of flow, but it's water, again, that we can use a treated effluent for that. We could have... we're anticipating that the perimeter of the plant. Well, I've touched on a treated effluent wetland for a project in Pacifica, California. Mm-hmm.
That's a famous project.
Yeah, and if the property could or the land could be found to site such a facility, then the effluent could be a potential use there.
Okay. Thanks, and yep. Thanks for everyone for putting up with all those questions.
Yeah. Hi, Steve. Could you be a little more specific when you stated that you were going to provide for provisions for Title 22? Does that mean setting aside some open land to add on some more treatment places or anything more than that? Or
Maybe the easiest way to looking in our site here is this box represents a tertiary filter, and this represents the chlorine contact basin. Now, actually, what we proposed, if you approve, we'll have two chambers here instead of one. And the addition of a second tertiary filter would allow us to then have a split flow where a portion of the flow could be routed through a second trickling filter into the second chamber of the chlorine contact basin, and that could be dedicated to Title 22 treatment. And then the flow that didn't go to Title 22 could go through the other filter, the other chlorine contact basin. Now, there might be times in a peak flow situation where you'd have to temporarily suspend Title 22 operation and make use of both filters and both basins to treat effluent before it went to the outfall. But that would be pretty infrequent. And quite frankly, the reclaimed water demand in a storm event is pretty minimal. So it seems like a reasonable trade-off. But the provisions for future Title 22, the way we're recommending it this time, would primarily be the addition of a second filter, and then there would have to be some pumps added to move the reclaimed water to whatever destination was identified.
Carla, anything? Any?
Okay. Sorry.
It doesn't surprise me.
Just some good follow-up to some of the questions that Mr. Smuggler was asking, and I think I might start with the rate thing and ask Mr. Wade to come up if you're in charge of rates. It was my understanding that the original upping of the rates back in a few years ago was to actually cover infrastructure, and that the cost to cover the new plant wasn't going to start until, when you said, 2013. Am I wrong in that?
It was more complex than that, but basically the timing of when we... In 2007, we did a big jump.
Mm-hmm.
And we did a big jump so that we would build a reserve to cover the some of the infrastructure projects that we need in our collection system. If you'll let me digress for a moment, we've been doing a lot of work on assessing the situation of our collection system. It's not as bad as we originally thought it was. So our estimates are probably high in that regard. So we don't think we'll use as much kind of going forward in time as we thought. But we still have significant investments to make in our collections infrastructure. So we timed our rate structure. It was really built, the end game of our rate structure was to have adequate rates in place in 2013. But the timing of it, we pulled it forward in time and made a big jump right at the front so that we could build some reserve. And the reserve was anticipated to cover potentially unanticipated project costs. As you move through the SRF process, there can be delays between when you incur the cost and when you actually recover the cost. There may be costs that you don't want to put into the project and you'll want to do under separate contract because of their requirements. So we put a little bit of fluff in there to kind of to buffer us. But you go, really, the rate that we'll be at in 2013 is the rate that the plant needs to support its payments into the future. And then the timing of it, we did it early so that we would build money between now and then so that we would have some money to do some of the other infrastructure projects.
So just to clarify, in 2013, where our rates will be the rate that we need to pay for the plant. And whatever buildup you've had up until that point, you're using for infrastructure.
That's effectively it.
So when you talk about reevaluating in 2013, why are we reevaluating in 2013?
It's a requirement of the SRF process.
Okay.
So basically, when you hit the midpoint of construction, right in this project, when you start at the concept, you have big risks because you have a very rough idea. As you progress through design, get into construction, you've passed those risk points and you've assumed some of those risks already, and so your risks become less. And so what SRF says is that midpoint of construction, you basically are going to have a really good idea of what your project's going to cost you. You're halfway there. And so they say come back at that point and readdress your rate structure. Their concern is that they want to get paid back. They don't want another Los Osos. And so you go, they basically, you have to come back midway through construction, look at your rate, and make sure it's adequate. They don't care about infrastructure. They don't care about anything else. Is it adequate to pay us back?
So are you saying we're not going to know the cost of this plant until 2013?
No, the cost of the plant, you go, all of your costs, regardless of your project delivery method, there are construction risks that you'll carry through the project. There are risks in regards to the underground utilities and their location that no project delivery method gets rid of. Probably your biggest risks, actually, no project delivery method gets rid of. So any project, really, until you're done with it, you won't know the actual final cost. And the design bid build, when you receive construction bids, and which would be in 2012 for us, based on our current schedule, we will have a real good idea of what our costs will be.
Mr. Hyland was speaking of when his preliminary draft is done, that he would have a pretty good estimate.
Yes.
And that would be an estimate of the cost of building.
Yes.
And is that, according to the schedule, not due until January?
That's about the right timeline.
Is there any way you can give us a cost earlier so we can do like this apples to apples comparison thing with the PERC thing?
Yes, it would not be as accurate because we wouldn't have advanced things as much, but
sure.
No, we could provide you our best estimate at this point in time of the facilities as laid out here.
Okay, so that we could have that next in the next meeting then, or whenever PERCs is due, yours could be due.
I think that's feasible, yeah.
Okay, and then to stay with this for just a minute, then when we reevaluate our costs in 2013, our rates, and you're saying that's where we're going to be in order to pay back the cost of building the plant, but will that also include new rates for just the monthly fee that needs to go to, again, continuing? So is that where the increase is going to come?
I'm not promising an increase in 2013.
Okay.
I don't know that we'll increase. We actually, okay. Right now we have a 7.5% on commercial, 5% on residential escalator. My original intent when I built the rate structure, we wanted to come back in 2013, peg ourselves to a different index, so probably like a CPI index, which is what we do on some of our other fees at the city, and then walk away from it for, you know, the next 20 or 30 years. But you go, you really have to get into it and get there to see.
Yeah.
But we did include, in that rate structure, we did look at sort of operational expenses for the plant. We did look at building sort of a maintenance fund for the plant. Mm-hmm. And we also looked at rehabilitation of the collection system at a fairly significant investment level, sort of going into the future. So really, we're coming back in 2013 not because we think we're going to need to, mm-hmm. but because we're SRF's going to require us to.
And I'm glad you said that about the operating maintenance, because with these larger facilities or bigger things that we need, and it's going to cost more, then, and Mr. Allen kept using the term modest increases, and I don't know what that word modest means. That makes me nervous. So are we talking like thousands of dollars, hundreds of thousands? I don't know what modest means. Can you give me a ballpark?
That's fair. It's subjective, but I think under the circumstances, when I'm saying modest, I'm talking about increases that are probably measured in the hundreds of thousands of dollars. But one example might be the secondary pump station. That's something that wasn't previously identified. That's probably somewhere between $500,000 to $1 million cost.
I have this memory, and I don't know if it's true or not, but every time that we raise the cost of the plant $1 million, that's another dollar on our bill. Is that approximately true, or did I make that up?
I don't think that was correct.
Okay.
And it will be dependent on, the rate of financing that we have on the project. And so you go, that also will be we've got to get through the environmental process before we can actually submit our SRF application, mm-hmm. and develop a funding agreement with them. Mm-hmm. So you go, that's another reason why you come back midpoint, is basically mm-hmm. to make sure that you're still in line with all the original assumptions.
Okay. And tell me if I'm out of line here, Mr. Highland. When you come back with your estimate for the new cost of the plant, can you insert operating with that so we know, like, maintenance and... Or will you have any idea about that yet?
We could provide an estimate of that. It wouldn't be, I'm going to say, super precise, if you will, but
yeah.
We can give you an order of magnitude, certainly. Yeah. Yeah. And one other thing I'd like to do is probably, in parallel with our estimate, attempt to compare it to what was developed in the facility master plan, so we
yeah.
can kind of see where the differences are, what is higher, what is lower, and just kind of bring this down to try to compare them apples to apples.
Yeah.
And then
I would like that. That would be
yeah.
great.
Okay.
Thanks. Sorry. I want to ask a question about this. We're going to bring in fill. It's going to bring us up 5 feet above elevation. And where I see this is on the old site, not the new site. Is the plant being moved back?
The direction that you guys gave us was to stay out of the trailer park if possible.
Okay.
It's possible.
It
so,
is possible. So that's yeah. what you're telling us now, that
correct.
In Amendment 2 we're going to go back to the regular
yeah,
site.
Yeah, remember we drew the big box, mm-hmm. Knowing full well we probably didn't need it.
Mm-hmm.
But and we've been very conservative this whole way through the process. So you go... we've made sure that we've kind of overstated our impacts. We've overdrawn our boxes to make sure that as we move through the process, we really don't want to come back and surprise you guys with something unpleasant. Mm-hmm. And so you go, yeah, we've shrunk down the area that's impacted as we've laid it out.
And does that go into the maintenance yard or the concrete company?
It goes through the maintenance yard and then into the jointly owned plant. Property on the other side, which is where the concrete plant is.
And so have you said where the yard's going to go then?
No, that's what we did do as preliminary work. I kind of knew where the corp yard stood in the pecking order of projects. We kind of knew that the wastewater plant was going to go where it needed to go, and then that the corp yard would have to sort of shake out and be looked at. So we did do feasibility. We did sort of a space needs assessment of the corp yard. So we did the groundwork. We have a good idea of what we think we'll need marching into the future. But how that all shakes out, we'll take this preliminary work, and in the next few years we'll have time to start looking at that. Certainly the flood impacts will be significant in terms of the courtyard and what you can and can't do there. And so you go, it'll ripple through kind of the city yard and the courtyard, and the flooding will actually even impact the desal plant. So it's kind of, you know, we made a big discovery there that the assumptions that everybody had been working under forever weren't correct, and once we found that out, that will impact, kind of, it'll ripple out into our other facilities.
The wall, Mr. Island, that you showed us around the building, is that the wall you refer to in the draft document? There's not another flood wall anywhere that's going to be built around this facility?
No, the plan would be to bring engineered fill into the site, mm-hmm. and all these facilities would be high and dry, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
The wall around the residuals facility is a screening wall for aesthetics and mm-hmm. To keep out the prevailing wind mm-hmm. from the operations.
Okay. Did that. All of these buildings are two-story. Are they going to be under 25 or up to 25 feet?
The operations building here will be two stories, and it would be designed to meet the height limitation. Now, bear in mind, it's 25 feet, or Dylan knows this better, but there's an offset. It can grow a little bit.
Yeah, you can grow back. Yeah,
but the operations building is effectively a two-story building here. The maintenance building, I would characterize it more like a one-and-a-half-story building because we're going to have a bridge crane in there. There won't be a second level, but it'll have a little bit extra height because mm-hmm. of the nature of the work that's going on in there.
Mm-hmm.
And then the residuals facility won't have a roof, but those perimeter walls, which are on the west, north, and east side, the screening wall will be effectively a two-story height.
I'll try to cut this down just to my last question here. And it goes back to where it says at the end of the document that we are meeting our secondary requirement by the regional board. So when you talk about putting in the tertiary filter, and you kind of alluded to this earlier, all the water is not going to be tertiary treated then. Is that right?
That's correct.
And do we have a percentage of which way that's going to go, or it's just what's the highest possibility it could be?
Well, I looked at year 2005, which in the period of time that the facility master plan, their period of record is from 2002 to 2005, and I think, or 2006, and 2005 was the highest flow during that period. And I assumed a hypothetical tertiary filter that was going to treat the average day flow of 1.5 MGD. And on an annual basis, 97% of the flow coming into the plant would receive tertiary filtration. 3% would, on 3% of the time, mm-hmm. or I should say on the gallonage that goes through the plant, would receive secondary treatment.
Okay.
And I might note that, bear in mind, that's going to happen during storm events
mm-hmm.
when the water quality is going to be poor in, like, for stormwater drainage and all those good things, so that the relative impact, if you will, is going to be less mm-hmm. than during. But putting in that tertiary filter, you are going one step beyond what you really need to do to meet mm-hmm. the regional board requirements.
Mm-hmm. Thanks.
Okay, Noah, I had one more question.
Yeah. I'm interested, I'm looking in here on the projected flows, and interested to talk or hear a little more description about how the peak flows was arrived at and how that relates to the inflow and infiltration. Some of the literature in here talks about INI not changing much because the population isn't going to change that much. So I guess I'm curious to know how our peak flows could increase 35% with increased rain when the INI seems to be less of an issue than we originally thought with the collection system. So how did that number, how do we arrive at that increase?
Let me take the first crack, and then Steve, you can back me up. You go, your collection system, your INI does increase during a storm event, and it also increases during periods of high groundwater, which would be sort of a sustained storm events. That's the inflow is particularly acute here in Morro Bay. And so you go, when it starts raining, we instantly see increases in the amount of water at the wastewater treatment plant. I mean, it's from what the guys have told me, you can kind of stand there and watch the meter come up as it starts raining. So you go, INI is a very large component of those peak flows. As your population grows, you're not really adding, especially in Morro Bay, with no sphere of influence, we're not adding new facilities, we're not running new kind of main lines out to Timbuktu. And so you go, our system isn't going to grow much. And so our INI piece of the flow regime doesn't really change with population growth because of the type of population growth that we'll have, which is infill development. So we're not really adding INI as we would grow. So basically your wet weather component doesn't change much with population because of our unique circumstances.
So that increase is almost entirely due to the INI of the peak wet season and the influence of the groundwater.
Yeah, the peak flows that you see at the plant, your peak hourly flow, your peak daily flow, those are INI related flows. You go, that's measuring effectively INI. You go, that's what causes those peaks is INI.
No,
I thought we were trying to correct those.
I'm
just going to add a comment here, is that if I'm hearing the question correctly, you want to know why you see the increase in the table here on the peak flow?
Well, I understand that we took a larger look at a more broad range of wet seasons. But I guess my question was, I'm surprised to see such a large increase in the peak flow. And, you know, I just wanted to hear whether confirm that was directly related to the INI completely, or if there was another influence that I didn't.
Your assumption is correct. I was just going to point out that really it was the addition of the historical record, the enlarging the years we looked at, because as a group for city and district staff, we've always wrestled with the fact we've come back with a lower average flow total coming into the treatment plant. And it's always been, you know, I'd just as soon make the thing like 10 times bigger and we could have as much water as we need to come in there, because I'm always the guy holding the cup, you know. And sometimes it's a little, like in 97, 98, we had some flows that came through for a 2 or 3 month period that are reflected in the data that you're seeing here, and we pick that data up. And truly, a lot of that flow is probably more inflow related, as Dylan pointed out, than infiltration. It's a direct, if you want to come down on the next big rain event, you can come down and watch the flow chart just increase almost the moment it starts to rain. And in answer to Betty's question, we're constantly working on it, but it's one of those things, it's probably like a cat chasing its tail. You're never going to catch it. We could fix everything tomorrow if that was even possible, and you could have an earthquake the next day and we'd be back in the same situation. But I know Dylan's putting a lot of time and energy into tracking that stuff down.
Yeah, kind of in the industry, your hope on INI is that you never get worse. And so you go, as you go through and rehab and rehabilitate and do smoke tests and work on it, you go, to think that you're going to get significant reductions in INI, it's never really happened. It's never really been documented that through a collection system that's in place, you can go through rehab it and cut your INI by, you know, 50%. It just doesn't really happen. Your INI is actually an interesting thing, and Steve can collaborate this, but as you move down the coast, so as you get into the drier environments, their INI is significantly lower than in northern cities in California. And so your INI is almost, it's a function of the condition of your collection system, but also of your geography and the timing and amount of rain that you receive.
I think it's your turn.
I think we'd like to take about a 10-minute break here before Cayucas jumps into this. So if that's agreeable, we'll see you at 9:45. Okay, we'll reconvene. Okay, I'd like to thank Morro Bay for their questions and also say that if there are questions from the audience here, we'll reserve a little time slot so that you can make some comments after Cayucas has had a chance. Before we continue, I'd like to ask, I'd like to clarify what our objective is tonight. Our agenda says to adopt the draft amendment number 2, and I'm concerned. I have several concerns. I don't know if now's the time to voice them. Tim, could you help us with what it is we're adopting tonight?
You're being asked to look at amendment number 2 to your facilities master plan, which is fairly narrow. It deals specifically with changes to the treatment process itself, and those changes are actually listed in page number 2 of your staff report. I'll just read them for ease. The changes to the treatment process between amendment 1 and 2 include the addition of grit removal in pretreatment, consolidation of screenings, grit removal, and sludge dewatering in a common residuals facility, the addition of a secondary pump station, deletion of sludge thickening and thickened sludge storage facilities, and designing the tertiary filter chlorine contact basin to accommodate future implementation of Title 22 reclaimed water. That's what you're looking at with regard to Amendment Number 2. And I know your concern was specific to design of structures, sort of architectural treatment of some of the facilities. At least I think that's what some of your concerns were. Is that right?
That, yes.
And you really haven't visited that subject. You have some depictions in the facilities master plan. They're more placeholders, if you will. They're more there just to hold the place. The design itself will have to be considered by the board fairly soon. I will note that for environmental purposes, and I think Rob Livick can certainly chime in here, you'll need to at least be considering, and I don't know how this is actually being conveyed to the board, sort of the mass and scale, the size and scale of the structures themselves. You do need to have some clarity on that subject as the environmental document moves forward. Those things need to be considered within the aesthetic evaluation criteria of CEQA. But the actual architectural treatment itself is going to be addressed by the board, I assume. I talked to Steve briefly about it in maybe a November or December, and it's not necessary at this point in time. But I assure you that the somewhat box-like, prison-like structures that you're looking at, Figure 6A, is not ultimately what you're going to see out there. That's going to depend on what the council and board do.
Okay, thank you, Tim.
Mr. Ernst, could I ask him something?
Yes.
So when it says in here, like, residual facility will be in a building with future construction if needed, are we approving that if needed thing so that's going to be decided later, or are we saying yes to that?
Well, I'll defer to Steve on that issue. As I understand it, you'll be approving it tonight, certainly in concept.
Okay.
But
thanks.
Steve, chime in.
Our intent was to design those screening walls so that if in the future, for whatever combination of reasons, you wanted to enclose the residuals facilities in a building, in other words, a fourth wall and a roof, it could accommodate that. In other words, the buildings would be designed structurally so that they could accommodate future building. Whether you would need to ever do that or not is unknown at this time. It's just when we design it, we want to provide that flexibility. It'd be foolish to design it so that you'd have to, if you did want to put a building around, you'd have to tear it down. That's all we're trying to avoid there.
All right. Thank you, Steve. Any other questions, Betty?
No, thank you.
Okay. Cayucas, questions? Michael?
I have some questions. First of all, Steve, I'd like to compliment you and the staff on the redesign of the site plan in amendment number 2 as opposed to what we had before. It's consolidated the footprint, preserved the trailer storage as a source of income, and I think it's definitely improvement. My question would be, is we seem to have picked up that the direction that we're trying to get to is to minimize the footprint of the site. Is this the minimum footprint that we can eke out for the capacity that we need?
No, I would say that there are opportunities as we advance the design to consolidate this even further and reduce the footprint. One example, for instance, the oxidation ditches are by far the biggest structure here. These are currently, the footprint that we show there, the area, is based on a 12-foot sidewater depth. I think there's a good opportunity, that is, that's the depth of water in there. What we were exploring with the manufacturers is the possibility of going to a 14 or 15-foot depth. And when we do that, same volume, but now we shrink the footprint and we can reduce the size of it. We've tried to strike a balance in this layout of being conservative so that if anything, we're going to reduce the footprint, reduce costs, but we want to, you know, the worst thing in my mind is to go into this and shove everything together and be really aggressive at this point in time. And then find out as we advance design and we get into more details that some things have to grow. We want to go the other way. So I think there is opportunity, and I think there's a good chance that we can reduce the size of this footprint as it currently is.
Okay, and just as a comment, if we can, that area along the highway on the
through there?
Yes. That is probably our second source of potential rental income-producing rental property, and so if we can move it along to consolidate it further, that would be terrific. I know that we've expanded the flows and loads on the 15-year history, but we've also sized the plant based on estimated capacity needs over the last 10 or 15 years. I think the original slide you had was 2015. Is that right? What the build out?
Yeah. For the city of Morro Bay, it was year 2021, and for Cayucas, it was year 2015. These are what the build-out populations are estimated to be reached.
Who's made those decisions? I mean, that.
In fairness to Steve, he didn't make those decisions.
Okay.
They came out of the original facilities master plan. I believe, and I'm certainly more versant with Morro Bay than with Cayucas' growth projections. In Morro Bay, we actually have an ordinance that limits our population to 12,500. Looking at our actual growth rate and projecting that into the future, we will not be at 12,500 in 2021. Our historic growth rate is less than 1%. And you know, our population's maybe 10.5 right now. So you go, what you've done is you've basically taken, in this case, I think ours came from the ordinance. That was an upper bound that's been set, and so it was an easy target to reach.
Okay.
In reality, we won't actually get there. In Cayucas, okay. I'm not sure of the methodology that you guys used. I'll let Bill answer that.
Okay.
Yep, Bill Callahan, Cayucas Sanitary District. Yep. Our build-out numbers are based on the number of lots currently within
right.
the service areas.
But that anticipates no density change, no rezoning of available land or anything else, no additional population growth, you know,
true,
in
that,
the future.
That's based on the county's projections.
And have we got a fudge factor in there if things change? I mean, we don't want to have to go back and resize the plant 5 years from now, right?
Right. I don't know that I can answer that question.
Okay. I look at this, correct me if I'm wrong, but I look at this facilities master plan amendment number 2 almost like a minor use permit, where we're sort of approving conceptually what it is that we want and proceeding to an EIR. And at any rate, my concern is with the soil study. You know, when you get a minor use permit to build a house, you have to have a soils report that determines, you know, whether you can support that structure. And my concern is that this design layout is predicated on assumptions of soil and soil remediation that is a huge variable expense that I don't think we have our hands around, and could make a significant difference in the layout of the plant.
I think that's a great analogy. The next step in the design process is to finalize. So we have a draft, sort of rough brush geotechnical analysis. What we found in that analysis is what we kind of, we knew it was an area of fairly high geologic instability as far as soil types, so that we thought there would be liquefaction potential. We thought there would be the potential for sediments based on loading. What we've done to address that risk to date is that through the project, we've actually held a placeholder in there. So we've held some money in the project scope. In amendment number 1, I'd have to find it to get the exact dollar amount, but we've basically held some money for remediation and soil stabilization to help us as we move through the process. But you go, the EIR does look at that as well. You get into it and you go, for that permitting process that we're about to embark on, we will be firming up the geotechnical report. That's actually on Steve's scope. That's one of his next major tasks. But it is an area of risk. Go ahead.
Let me just add in. The preliminary geotechnical investigation was based on actual site borings that were done last year by the environmental subconsultant. So they cross-sectioned the site with some site borings to establish what they believe would be that differential settlement. But that was not based on, when the geotech moves forward, they will be basing their work on the design effort that's been advanced to this point. So they'll just be refining those numbers.
Well, okay, I'm not sure that I understand what you're saying, but the soil removal, the bringing in of engineered fill is a very expensive process, and if you know, I'm once again, I'm back to this, the smaller the footprint, the less of that you have to do. And does that affect the design consideration of the plant? If it's twice as expensive as what we think it's going to be, we might rethink the plant design.
I'll take a crack at this, and then Steve can jump in if I get it wrong. Not all of your structures will require subsoil the same level of mitigation. You go, the fill is largely being brought in to basically protect against flooding. So rather than building a flood wall, we're raising the whole facility up and out of the floodplain. Certainly, as you reduce the size of the facilities, you have to raise less area out of the floodplain, and so you can reduce your cost through that process. In terms of geotechnical, it depends really on each individual structure. You're going to have to look at it. For example, the maintenance building. The maintenance building is probably going to be a typical slab of grid structure. It can allow for and accommodate more settlement than perhaps some of the hydraulic structures, and it wouldn't cause as much settlement. So you're going to look at it on a structure-by-structure basis as you move through the design process. But consolidating all the facilities, for example, piling wall into one, may make that problem worse, and that you've now loaded that soil more severely, and you may have more extensive mitigation measures to install. So it's not really a linear relationship, and it's not exactly a square footage relationship, and that it's dependent on the loading condition caused by the building.
How much money do we have as a placeholder for soil remediation costs in our budget?
I believe, let me grab my notes real quick. I've got that available. They're firing ranges at me. I think we had 1.6 to 1.8 million in the budget to do that.
And do we have any idea whether that's adequate?
That number was based off of the work that happened in 1985. To large portions of the existing site had subsoil remediation done. And so the placeholder was built basically saying off of that work. So it was based off of real numbers that was escalated forward. But I wouldn't say that that's a precise estimate. It's really just a placeholder. So that will move around some as we move through the design process. And it could go up some, it could go down a little bit.
Mr. Foster, could I jump in for a minute?
Yeah. I mean, by what range can it go up or down? I mean, can we get our hands around that number a little bit better?
John Hanlon from AECOM, district engineer for Cayucas. The best way to get that estimate is to have the geotechnical report advanced. And for us to do that later in the design process, that geotechnical report will appreciate the structures, the size of the basins that you're describing. So the only way to really get a handle on that cost of the subsurface mediation is to proceed with the geotechnical report.
That doesn't seems to me that that's an interactive process, and what you're saying is we're going to design it the way we want to design it, and whatever it costs to do the soil remediation, that's what it's going to cost, and that's exposing us to a lot of uncertainty, as far as I'm concerned.
Let me clarify. If I give you that impression, that's incorrect. You're going to design it with soil remediation basically in consideration. I mean, that's going to be a primary consideration for the structures on this site.
I'm sorry. Betty, did you? I interrupted you.
No, that's fine. I don't know how important this is. If we're going to have to spend 1.6, say, at a minimum, or 1.5 and up on soil remediation, I would like to know the comparison of that to moving the plant up on the tank farm at Dynegy, and I would assume it would mean the cost of the piping, and would the piping be equivalent to $1.5 million? And then we wouldn't have to do the soil remediation, we wouldn't have to be in the floodplain.
It's probably the same soil.
Oops. I would anticipate, based on what we know about the power plant site, that you'd have to do the similar effort there. In addition, it would be more than just the cost of the pipe, and you'd have to pump it there. And so you would basically add a pumping station. You would have to cross the creek and determine how you're going to do that. Granted, big projects carry big risks to them. And so as you move through the process of designing the project, you basically are anticipating the risks that the project has and adjusting accordingly and basically trying to design a project that best fits your objective and balances your risk. I mean, that's the process of designing a plant. That's kind of what you're going through and doing. So we're working on that. Like I said earlier, as we move through the process, we've met those risks, and you go, we move past them as you move through the process. But there are some you carry through to the end. I mean, you go, it just is a big project, carries some big risks with it.
You know, I agree with that. The issue is are we doing everything that we can to quantify those risks and to mitigate those risks? I spoke last month and identified 7 different risks and tried to quantify what I thought those were. The first one was that the actual cost in 2013 would exceed our 2006 estimates, and I quantified that risk at $450,000 to $900,000, and that's already come in from 2006 to 2009 at $3 million over. So I think we should, you know, realize that we could be talking about something greatly, that there's a lot of these risks, including this soil remediation, that could drive the project costs of this catastrophically higher. And my concern is that we are not doing enough work now to try to quantify those risks.
Okay, any other questions, Cayucas? I'm going to make just a couple comments here. First, based on the fact that the buildings are, we're reserving our right to talk about the design. I wanted to be sure that there was a letter sent to Regional regarding the schedule. I think I saw a draft of that. Bill, you signed it, and Andrea. Okay, thank you very much for doing that. Steve, I wanted to be sure we had we at the TAC meeting, we discussed this second chlorine chamber, and I want to know whether we're including that or not including it this evening, and are we supposed to vote on that or as a change, or what's the status with that?
We would very much like for the boards to approve amendment number 2 with the provision that we would have 2 chamber chlorine contact basin.
Okay, good. And I wanted to report that at the TAC meeting, I believe we wholeheartedly agreed with that approach. Morro Bay, did you have – Janice, you were there. Would you care to comment on that?
I agree with what you're saying, yes.
Okay. My other concerns there simply are that we're using a lot of real estate for a road in and a parking lot, and that hazardous waste facility, as I recall – we were kind enough to give them a little space on our original plant, and I'm looking at that, and they have, with the parking lot and that, they have almost as much space as we're using for the entire rest of the treatment plant, and I would just like to address that somewhere down the road. You don't need to comment on it. There was some question about raising the site. I want to look at 2 things there. In the PERC design that we saw in Santa Paula, a lot of their tanking, concrete wall tanking facilities were underground. As I recall, in that particular site, they were 18 down and the 24 overall. Is that about right, Rob? Plus or minus for concept. I'm just at this point thinking that if PERC comes with their design and we're saying we need to go up 5 feet just to get out of this subsurface water issue, and they're planning on going down 18 feet or some number, something's not adding up in my mind as whether or not that's possible on their behalf.
Let me try to clarify. The engineered fill to raise the site 5 feet where the new facilities are going to go is to mitigate against flooding, external flooding from Morro Creek in a storm event. There will be groundwater below the surface, And the hydraulic structures you're looking at there, like the oxidation ditch and particularly the secondary clarifiers, will probably encroach into the groundwater depth. Okay, so we anticipate, even with raising the site, that the depth of, in particular, the secondary clarifiers, the bottom of those clarifiers will be getting into the groundwater. And so that has to be addressed in the design to make sure that they don't float.
Okay, so if I'm understanding that right, we're burying some of those, some portion of those chambers.
Correct.
Okay.
The oxidation ditch, secondary clarifiers, chlorine contact basin, there will be portions of those structures that are below grade.
Okay, good. Thanks. Rob, did you want to say something?
Yeah, I just wanted to clarify that, again, we're raising the site to protect the site from surface flows from Morrill Creek coming out of its banks, and we're raising to protect those structures, facilities that can be damaged during flooding events.
And does that 5 feet we were discussing, on your building heights, do you go from the average natural grade? So you're going to, the 5 feet is the
we're going to be losing height. 5 feet because the building height is based on the existing average natural grade.
Okay, I just wanted to clarify that.
Mr. Ernst, could I ask a question about flooding?
Yes.
I know that we need to meet some federal flooding permission. Have they seen the 5 feet, and are they happy with that, or are we waiting still to hear from them?
We have just submitted our letter of map revision, or our LOMAR application, to FEMA. Their plan checkers have seen the work. Our consultant, the Wallace Group, was coordinating with Michael Baker and Associates, which is FEMA's plan checkers, to make sure that things were acceptable to them before they submitted. But they just made their official submittal to FEMA. We expect that is a rigorous process that FEMA will put this project through and put our consultants through. It will probably take 3 to 6 months before we get an answer on that, but we anticipate we'll get the answer to reduce those flood flows, and that we'll only have to deal with that 5 foot of fill, as we believe that FEMA was and the Army Corps was very conservative when they initially established those flood flows.
Okay, just one more thing, Steve. When we had our TAC meeting, you presented, I think, 4 different alternative concepts. And if we're going to make a motion here to adopt this draft amendment number 2, and we attach to that this, we say that including the second chlorine chamber, is that adequate to cover option number B or whatever it was we did?
I believe it is, yes.
Okay. Yes. So when we get ready to make a motion, I want to be sure I have what you need.
Okay. Thank you.
Any other comments?
I do have a follow-up comment on that component with the disinfection. We've talked around the concept of UV. We haven't done anything formal to analyze or compare UV disinfection with the chlorination. And I'm anticipating that UV would be part of the PERC proposal that comes back, which will give us some element of evaluation. I guess the question I'd ask the board is that enough, or would we like to have some UV evaluation included as we go forward with this element as well? So is the board comfortable that the UV proposal from PERC will give us what we need to compare and contrast the benefits and the negatives of the two options?
I think I'd ask Dylan. Can you answer that question?
I was actually looking back to talk to Rob from representing PERC. Based on there's considerations that will drive you one way or another in regards to chlorine or UV. Certainly, I think as we move through the design process, we can take a closer look at that. But at first blush, there's some concerns about, I would have concerns with UV, and that because of how we've designed the tertiary filtration, UV lends itself to basically water with not much transmittance in it. And so you go under like a bypass condition or during a wet weather event, your water could have some color or low transmissivity, and UV would be particularly challenging to use in those circumstances. So you go at kind of first blush, my guess is it's probably not the right fit for the project. I'm not sure that PERC will even come back with UV as a recommended alternative. But certainly as we carry the design forward, we can put some more consideration and more effort into that.
So an action identifying this dual chlorination chamber wouldn't preclude that evaluation that you're mentioning as we go forward. Okay, great.
Thank you. Michael?
Are we discussing the staff report, Agenda B1, now, too? Or
Yes.
Yeah, you know, on page 4 of that report, it's important to note that current MBCSD is behind schedule on the environmental and permitting portion. Based on the adoption of this will not... The failure to complete Project Milestones carries potential penalty of $100 a day. The total fine exposure to date would be in the $50,000 range. I don't recall in the last 2 or 3 months this being brought to our attention, that we were... this is news to me.
I think in past staff reports it's been indicated that we had not made the date for publishing the EIR. This is the first time we put a number to it. We went back and looked at that date, and I believe the date was February 27, 2009. And if we don't publish public notice until August 2010, you're about, we're guesstimating somewhere in the 500-day range behind schedule. So we put a number to that figure. And as it notes in there, if the project is completed on time, as with all milestones, the agreement does state that they will waive the interim penalties. So it's kind of an incentive to bring the milestones forward.
Okay. Michael, anything else? Are we ready for a motion? I wanted to see if there was anyone in the public that would like to make a comment at this time.
Richard Margetson. Richard Margetson, Cayucas. First comment is the staff report today. I stopped at the Morro Bay City offices. It was in the front lobby. I asked for copies to be made. It ended up being very expensive to make copies, but they said it was on the website. I went to my computer, pulled it up on the website, was not able to pull the staff report up. In the future, I would hope that we could have a staff report here at the meetings. Almost every other meeting in the county, the staff packet is somewhere in the room or in the lobby or something. I think it's only fair to the audience. When you're looking at something, we should be able to also. My real concern why I came to give public comment is we keep hearing about this comparison at some point down the road that we're going to have between this project and PERC. My concern is how has it been decided that this analysis is going to happen? On your June 16th meeting, Steve Hyland did a presentation, a PowerPoint presentation, comparing the oxidation dish to the membrane bioreactor. The slide on installed motor horsepower was put up on the slide as a comparison of the two projects. The first column for horsepower for oxidation ditch, the numbers don't add up to the total horsepower at the bottom of the column. The total horsepower for membrane bioreactor, though, does. So right there, that piece of information is incorrect. That information came forward in comparing what the cost would be. So at the start, you have inaccurate information on number of horsepower needed. Leads into the cost analysis, leads into the total project cost analysis. If we're going to have this apples-to-apples thing, it needs to be apples-to-apples. And I want to know who's checking both sides, because I think if PERC gave that demonstration on the 16th, their demonstration might have been completely different. Montgomery Watson Harz is obviously going to give a biased presentation to favor their, what they've been working on. Another thing I would like to be part of the comparison is one's going with the SRF, the other is probably going to do their own financing, provide their own financing. Make sure that in the cost of this, because I was intimately involved in the SRF process in Los Osos, and the reason the SRF became a fiasco in Los Osos is because the state water board did not listen to the community. Busloads of citizens went up to the water board meetings over the years and asked them not to give us the additional 50% bump on the original authorization. And there's also a number of components tied to the SRF, number of hoops you're going to have to jump through. And you also have to add in your administrative costs for administering that loan. Those are going to be much more significant than PERC's provided financing, which is going to be rolled into their total cost. I had one other thing I wanted to mention. I think that was it. Thank you.
Thank you. I would comment that we had approved a small contract to Kitchell Company to do this evaluation. So, Bruce, I see taking notes. We'll make sure we address those items. With that, I'd ask for a motion from Cayucas.
I would like to make the motion as recommended with an amendment. The motion would be adopt amendment number 2 to the facility master plan, and secondly, select option B1 as a preferred disinfection strategy to include the additional chlorine chamber.
I'll second that.
Okay, is that the right B1 is the correct one? I want to make sure. Thank you. All right. Any other discussion on Cayucas? If not, all those in favor say aye. Aye.
Aye.
Do I hear 5? No.
I vote no.
Oh, 1 no. All right. Morbey?
All right. I'll make the same motion.
I have a question.
You need to wait. Let's go ahead. We've got a motion. Do I have a second?
Second.
Okay. Discussion.
Yeah, my discussion is we talked during our questions about including or requesting the MWH to bring back the estimates for operations and maintenance as well as construction and capital costs with the adjustments within 30 days. And I don't know if that needs to be part of the motion or if that's already in the process and will happen.
I want to be fair to Steve. Amigo, I think we discussed bringing it back in conjunction with the documents prepared by PERC. Those at preliminary estimates, we're expecting to have a draft, I believe September 6th is the date on that, so it would be longer than 30 days. I don't know that it needs to be part of the motion. We can take that direction and follow it.
Okay, great. I just wanted to confirm that we would get that in appropriate timing.
Okay. I'm going to add something to the discussion, too. There's been a lot of concern about whether these estimates are accurate or not. I think that all of the staff people here have been extremely responsible in doing their estimates. They've been very conservative. That's been proven. And I think that we need to recognize that and appreciate it and trust them that they're still going to be that way. This is a big project for all of them. And I don't think any of them wants to risk their reputation on doing it wrong. So I think that I just want to voice my appreciation. You've actually come in under some of the estimates already, and I think that's terrific. And they are trying to keep us on schedule, and I appreciate that as well. So with that, any other discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? None. Okay. 5-0.
Thank you very much. With that, we'll go to item B2, status report on the project management.
Yeah, I'll introduce that. At the last couple meetings, there has been discussion on the hiring of a project manager to coordinate and oversee the upgrade project. The council and district board approved an RFP for project management services on May 13th. We public noticed it on May 18th, and we closed it on June 9th. We received four proposals from firms. We have narrowed that down to two firms, and then we performed interviews, and those interviews were held on June 30th. We are at the current time. We have a recommendation on who we would like to see, would recommend for the award of contract, and we are working with that firm to negotiate a contract at this time. We had hoped to try and bring that contract back for consideration at this meeting, but it just wasn't possible. So the original recommendation that we put forward is that since you're going to have a TAC meeting on July 15th, I believe it is, that we would convert that TAC meeting to a special meeting of the JPA so we could award that contract. The goal there is to bring the project manager on board as quickly as possible. There seems to be more moving parts to this beast all the time, so all the help we can get would be appreciated. I have heard this evening that there's at least two members of the council that will not be present next week, and so I don't know if having a special meeting is possible at this time, but I would throw that out to the board and council. Worst case scenario is that if we can't get a special meeting arranged, we would bring this the project manager back at the August 12th JPA meeting for consideration and award of contract. Prior to award of contract, we will have a kind of a presentation and a question and answer with the project manager so that the board and the district council, or the board and the council, can ask questions and interact with that person, and subsequent to that, they can vote on award of contract. So I'd kind of throw it out to the board and council right now whether they choose to have a special meeting, whether it's even feasible and possible, or whether they would just prefer to wait until the August 12th meeting date that we would which would be our normal JPA meeting.
Question on that. If we do wait until August 12th, then how long after that before the person would be on board and working?
I think that we would have a negotiated contract, and we would probably be ready to have that person work within 3 to 5 days just to make sure that the insurance requirements are all met and all that stuff. We might even be able to do that ahead of time, but they're going to have to provide some certifications and endorsements that may take a couple days. But certainly we would work to have that person be on board as quickly as possible.
And are either of the candidates were considering other offers that might take them away from us if we don't act soon?
No, actually, the candidate that we would recommend has actually, during the interview process, indicated that he had turned down some work, and he's very interested in this project and would really like to work with both city and district staff and the council and the board, and he thinks it's a very exciting project, and he's looking forward to working with us.
Okay.
Okay. Will Cayucas be available July 15th, Bruce?
For January, next week on the 15th?
Yes.
I will, because I have a staff meeting there.
I'm with you. Michael, Al? Okay, but do we have a problem with if we went ahead with it without the full board? Do we see any problems with? Well, with less than a full board to approve. I mean, we obviously can do it with three people.
So you can't be there.
I'm not certain. It looks like we have three, though. So.
Okay. I believe Cayucas would be comfortable with at least a majority of the board to make this approval. If we could keep that meeting on the July 15th, I think it would keep us ahead of the game. I'd like to see the guy get on board right away.
It's July 14th, right?
14th.
Wednesday? 15th. Okay, I had the wrong day. My only concern was I don't want to give up the TAC meeting because we've got business that we need to accomplish. Assuming that this decision would not be that time-consuming, could we do both?
How about if we do that one item and then adjourn to a TAC meeting since we'll have staff there?
I mean, I would just hate to lose the momentum we need on the TAC. Okay, Council?
I'm going to object because I'm unavailable and made plans to be out of town, and I want to be able to have an opportunity to hear the potential candidate since I didn't sit in on interviews.
My concern is different than Ms. Borchardt's. Mine is that, and I did get to sit in on both of the interviews, but I guess I'm relating it to how we did the management partners. Staff came back with several options, and then we chose. And what's happening here is that staff has whittled it down, but we're not going to get to choose between the two. They've chosen, again, and they're going to give us that recommendation. I like to be the decision maker. I want to be the one that chooses. I want to be able to say, this is what I thought was good about this guy, and this is what was good about this guy. But I don't feel like I'm going to have that opportunity. And I guess I'd like for us to make that decision based on how we kind of did the management partners thing. We were given a variety of information. We reviewed that, and then we chose. But I don't see that happening here. And maybe it's a different process. I don't know. But I guess I'm surprised when I read this report that that was already kind of a done deal, and all we're going to be doing is rubber stamping, in essence.
Noah, do you have a comment?
Yeah, I guess that's my concern as well, especially in the scenario where we didn't approve the recommended consultant. There's no real follow through to bring the alternative or to evaluate the alternative option and make the decision that night. So it would seem we'd be setting ourselves up, if we don't approve the recommended option, to have a more delay on bringing the PM on board.
Cayucas, do you have any comments on that?
Speaking for myself, I'm comfortable with the staff recommendations.
Okay. All of you are comfortable.
My biggest concern is that we get this guy on board. If there's another date that works better where we can get everyone that's as soon as possible, I'd suggest we do it.
Well, it seems that the question that's being brought up over here is whether we should be able to actually see both of the top candidates. Is that something that Cayucas would?
I'd suggest that if you don't, we interview the one candidate that staff has selected, and if you don't like him, throw him out.
And I would agree with that staff's recommending an individual or firm, and if we don't accept that, then I'd be willing to look at the second alternative. But I'm not an engineer, so I'm going to go based on their expertise.
So I think that they need to have the strongest input, shall we say. Yes, Mr. Schultz.
Good evening. I just want to get up and say I was here. I hadn't spoken yet, which rarely happens. No. Certainly, staff has a recommendation that they've picked, and we'll bring that forward to you. As to the second one that they interviewed, I'm certain we'll have to tell him that they're not our recommendation, and they certainly could come to the meeting, and we could provide an opportunity to speak, or you could provide them with answers. I mean, I think they would know that they're not the recommendation, but that doesn't prevent them from coming and answering any questions you might have. So it might alleviate that situation. Just an idea.
I was assuming we were getting written reports like we did before, but sounds like we're not.
There is four proposals. Those are all available by PDF, and all of those proposals were put in your the read basket. Yeah. They're very long, so you do have the four proposals.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, I read those.
And then staff might have pluses or minuses. Reasonings for choosing them.
Okay. I just want to make sure that we don't end up in that meeting not deciding on the recommendation and then not being able to make a final decision that night on the alternative, and then therefore creating more delays.
Which would mean it's better to do this on the 15th.
on the 15th, and perhaps include Mr. Schultz's recommendation that there's an element of review of the alternative option as well.
And that means we'd be doing it with three council members. Two of you would not be here.
Well, no, I can make arrangements to be here on the 15th.
Okay.
Unless there was another council member that can't.
Carla.
Besides Carla.
Well, again, this is something that, okay, I'm going to say vote of the council then. How do you want to do this? Do you want to go ahead and proceed on the 15th, knowing that Carla can't be there? Or do you want to wait until the August meeting and then run into a potential of what do we do if we don't approve them?
I'd be real surprised if we don't approve it, and if Ms. Borchard would like to be there, I'm willing to wait.
Why don't we consider 2 weeks from tonight instead of a week from tonight? Would that do it?
I'll be gone. No, it's okay. I'm going to be gone. No, I said I was willing to wait for you.
Thank you. All right, then I'm going to look to the attorneys. We have Cayugas wanting to move ahead on the 15th. We have Morro Bay not wanting to move ahead on the 15th. What do we do? Separate approvals?
I don't want to raise this specter, but this is not a JPA decision under the agreement. It can be done at individual
okay.
meetings if that eases the pressure. So, you know, you could do it.
Your meeting's on the our meeting's on the 21st? 21st.
You know, and this may put pressure on the applicant if he's required to be at both meetings, but we could do ours on the 21st. I don't know. You meet on the first and third Tuesday, so you could do it on the third Tuesday. I'm just throwing it out there as an option to sort of break the stalemate.
But, you know, we had discussed that option a little bit, but due to some of the comments made by the council and the board members that, you know, this person is going to be an intermediary between all consultants and the board and council, we kind of thought it would be better.
And we can ask some questions. How's that sound?
Just the point of order, didn't on our June 10th meeting, didn't we task the staff with interviewing and engaging this person?
Yes.
So why are we now?
Why are we now re-interviewing?
Well, I agree with you. I have every confidence that staff has picked the very best candidate, and you know, I'm pleased to meet him on the 15th or the 21st or in August if that's what we'd like to do. But I believe the mayor just complimented staff on the job they did, and I'm going to just reiterate that and say I have every confidence that who you've picked for us to talk to or to meet is the best there is. Thanks.
My sentiments also.
If I may add, this is one of the most important decisions we have to make because of the liaison. And I think, again, we did ask the staff to make the preliminary findings. And I would then say we should trust the staff to do it right.
So it sounds like a majority
is ready to vote now.
Yeah,
that's what I'm wondering. Is this something we could decide tonight? I don't think so. It's only we're supposed to schedule a special meeting to award a contract. That's what it says. All right, so it sounds like, all right, we've got Cayucas ready for a special meeting on the 15th.
Yes. Mayor Peters,
yes.
Can I review the proposal if there's an opportunity before I leave town and proxy my vote? No?
No, but you could write a note to us and let us know what your position is.
You certainly could vote remotely, though. Telephonically, if you want to do that.
All right. So we're agreed. We'll go ahead on the 15th. All right. And is that going to be at 3:30 on the 15th, which is when the TAC meeting is going to be, or is it going to be earlier, later? What?
1 to 3 is the TAC meeting.
1 to 3 on the 15th.
Where will it be, please?
It's at the Vets Hall in Morro Bay.
In Morro Bay?
Mm-hmm.
All right, so we're going to have it at 1, and as soon as we've made this decision, we will break to the TAC meeting.
Yeah, I think we can do that. Actually, in response to Ms. Lyons, you guys were supposed to, the CSD is supposed to host this meeting for the TAC, but I kept the room at the Vets Hall in the under the conditions that if you guys wanted to have a special meeting, I don't think your conference room is big enough to host a special meeting. It might be a little tight.
Okay, thank you, Bruce.
All right, so it'll be in Morro Bay at 1 o'clock on the 15th.
Very good. Thank you, everybody.
Okay. And can I just clarify that? You want to have a we'll notice a special meeting.
Okay.
One agenda item will be on that meeting, which will be the PM. When that's over, if there's time still available, we will adjourn and segue into the TAC.
That's
yes.
correct.
Yes.
Is there still a motion on the floor?
Okay, with that, we'll go to item C.
This item is a discussion and consideration to send a letter to the Regional Water Quality Control Board and US EPA requesting a reduction in the monitoring frequency for selected parameters contained in the monitoring and reporting program for our NPDES discharge permit. The treatment plant, the NPDES discharge permit for the treatment plant has a monitoring and reporting program that specifies what you're to test for and how often you are to test for it. As noted in the staff report, our NPDES permit is listed on the city website, so if you want to check out the monitoring and reporting program, you're more than welcome to do that. The permit is really long. It's 100 pages long, so I chose not to include it as an attachment. The permit specifies that for certain parameters in the permit that if you test and analyze for certain constituents during the first year of the permit and you don't find those constituents, that you may request for regional board to reduce the frequency of monitoring for those parameters. Most of the parameters that we're discussing in the staff report actually occur on an annual basis. And the justification for doing that is actually a reasonable potential analysis conducted by Dr. Doug Coates at Marine Research Specialists, our offshore monitoring consultant. The reasonable potential analysis is a tool used by State Board, and it's primarily used if you were to apply for a new NPDES discharge permit, they would look at the monitoring data that you have. They would run some statistical analysis, and they would determine primarily whether you even needed to have an effluent limit in your permit. So it's really designed to construct the permit when it first comes out. In our case, we ran the reasonable potential analysis based on 25 years of monitoring data since the plant was upgraded in 1984. And it's a very intensive analysis. I didn't include the calculations. There's about 180 pages of calculations that go with the reasonable potential analysis. But it basically determines what the probability of either detecting the constituent is or what is the possibilities of actually exceeding the concentration that's listed in the permit. So Dr. Coates ran that analysis. We sent a copy of, I've been talking to Regional Board about this situation for about the last 8 or 9 months, and we sent a copy of the reasonable potential analysis to both US EPA and Regional Board staff, and they both concurred that on a technical basis, the reduction in monitoring frequency that's included in the RPA is both appropriate and justifiable. So they haven't been real. I can't say that their staff is leaping up in the air to do this because it involves some staff time for them. But it does provide for cost savings in our monitoring program over the life of the permit. And any of the parameter frequency in an NPDES permit is considered a permit modification, and it would have to go in front of the board. So what would happen is we'd send the letter into Regional Board and EPA. That would kind of start the process rolling. They would have to go through a public comment period. They'd actually have to – what I'm being told is they would probably process it as a resolution, so it would kind of be an amendment to the permit. And that resolution would have to be public noticed, public comment received, and then that resolution would be placed on the regional board's one of their regular meeting dates, and the regional board would actually have to hear and approve of that reduction in monitoring. And there's no guarantee that the board will do that. I can say, though, that many of the effluent parameters that are being listed in this RPA in 25 years of monitoring, we've never detected them. And there is really no chance, based on the makeup and the demographics of the community, that you're likely to see any of those constituents either A, be detected, or C, have a chance to violate the permit. So with that, I'll open it up to questions.
Just one. We talked about, instead of annual testing, to ask for once every 5 years in the staff report, but I didn't see that language in the letter. Is that in there?
Basically, the letter references the RPA letter that sits behind it from Dr. Coates. It's about, a 13-page document. And really, the letter is really an introduction to the reasonable potential analysis that Dr. Coates did. And the meat of the matter is really contained, and the justifications are really contained in that RPA.
Okay, and if we've never realized detectable amounts of these products, why has it taken us so long to get to the point where we're asking to,
Well, what's happened over the years, at least since I've been involved in 2 permit renewals, and in each and every permit renewal cycle, we make a lot of recommendations to regional board staff. And a lot of those recommendations have actually improved our monitoring program. And Dr. Coates would kind of be applauded for that, because he's the one that has tightened the sampling points around the outfall. They could never find us when they originally designed the program. And his specialty is in offshore monitoring. So every permit cycle we have provided extensive recommendations to regional board. Some of them have been accepted, some have not. I believe the footnote that was listed in our current permit is based off of comments we provided during the last permit renewal cycle. We asked to have this stuff done before, and the answer is no. And to be consistent with other dischargers, you will at least have to sample once in the life of the permit. And the other answer is that because we have a 301H permit, it carries with it a little bit more extensive monitoring program. But regional board was willing to put that footnote in during this last permit and let us move forward. So that's kind of why we're bringing it out now.
Any other questions?
With savings.
They give you what you are allowed to discharge into the ocean, and then they backtrack into the volume of effluent you're discharging and kind of do some calculations and tell you this is what your effluent limit should be. At this point in time, we expanded the monitoring program based on a lot of what the NRDC brought forward. We're doing more nutrient monitoring. It seems like as much as the program's been simplified, it gets more complicated. But the money you save here will go directly back into the wastewater treatment plant budget. So really, it's a cost savings. And, I don't like the term, but sometimes we're monitoring for monitoring's sake because we're required to, and I think even regional board staff would concur with that. They have reviewed this. Actually, the person that did the review at the state board level wrote the document on how to proceed with the RPA and came back and said it's rock solid.
Any other questions? Cayucas?
Any comments from Cayucas?
Sounds terrific to me.
Bud, do you want to put a motion for
a motion? Shirley, did you have something else?
Oh, okay. In keeping with the presentation we just heard from Mr. Keough, I would move to send a letter to Regional Water Quality Control Board and US EPA requesting a reduction in monitoring frequency for selected parameters contained in the monitoring and reporting program of the NPDES discharge permit for the wastewater treatment plant.
I second.
Any other discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Aye. Motion carries.
Same motion, Laurel Bay.
Move approval of C1.
Second.
Any discussion?
Just one more question, Mr. Keough. The six that were above just slightly, and you attributed that could have been just a testing error. Is it if you get rid of all of them, you can't just keep those six and look at them?
You can. I mean, it's you kind of have the buffet menu there.
Yeah.
But truly, I mean, if you read the
I read the text.
Analysis from Dr. Coates, and you look at the last table where he's talking about, he assigns numbers.
To them?
Yeah.
So will you be doing this at the beginning of each cycle or just randomly during the 5 years?
We have already sampled once in July of the permit was renewed in March of 2009. Mm-hmm. We did the first full semiannual effluent analysis in July of 2009. We kicked this subject around a lot with regional board and tried to kind of see what we could do to fast track it, and it didn't seem to go very fast. We just did another full suite of analyses. So in this permit cycle, we would actually have done two.
Two. And you haven't gotten those results back yet?
No, we just actually sampled, I think, on the 1st of July. But there's no indication that...
There's going to be an issue?
Yeah.
Yeah. And how long does it take to get those answers back?
Anywhere from, we have to report those numbers, I think, by the end of, generally by the month following the sampling. So anywhere from
hurdles and processes for us to follow to begin that process of reclamation and go down that road. So I would recommend that as a JPA board, we also agendize that for a future meeting to be discussed and updated on what would be involved with reclamation.
Okay. Bruce, would that be an assignment to staff then to do some homework? Dylan?
Yeah, it's actually a topic we've already discussed. We've done some initial work at a staff level. It may be, and I don't want to step on anybody's toes here, but it may be best that you know, reclamation, Morro Bay is going to be more interested, I think, in reclamation at this point, and we probably should do some late work before we bring it back to this board. It would be my recommendation. And we have a study that was done in 1999. What we'll look at is pulling that study out. We're going to post it on our website, dust it off, and then use that to sort of springboard the discussion. But there's a fair amount of research involved in really developing a mature discussion here. So I think we can probably do a little legwork on our end and then bring it back to this board is how I would recommend we do it. But if the board wants to take action on that and have us pursue it, we certainly will.
Well, I'm not saying that we should have a date and a timeline, but to put it on the future agenda item list so when the time is appropriate, it comes back to us and we've already laid the groundwork for it to happen was my suggestion.
I think that's fair.
Okay, right. So not for the next meeting.
Not
for
the next meeting.
Okay.
Anything else?
Yes, I would like to. I'm not sure exactly what the procedure is, but I have some thoughts on reorganizing a little bit, adding a couple of committees to the JPA to sort of help with the staff on the workload, identify some of these other aspects of this development, and I would like to present that to the JPA. I'm happy to work with the staff first that they can comment, or anyway, I'd like to schedule 10 or 15 minutes to make that presentation either on July 15th or August 12th.
Okay. We good there?
Not for July 15th, I would hope. Because that's going to be he said July 15th through August 12th. July 15th is going to be a one-topic meeting, and then we go to the TAC. That's what we had decided. So
we could put it on August 12th?
Okay.
Thank you. Anything else? I'd like to thank Steve Hyland for a very nice presentation, Steve. Enjoyed that. Very well presented. Thank you. With that, I'd say we're adjourned.